Well, hello, friends. I'm Avery. Welcome to the Chiller Queen podcast. This is where I dive deep into the unknown. And if you're anything like me and you trust nobody, let me take you on a journey down the rabbit hole. I'm going to present to you some of the most mind-blowing stories that will send chills down your spine. Or have you wondering just what kind of world we are living in? The stories I cover come out of the world of true crime, crazy conspiracies, and bizarre true stories. In a world full of smoke and mirrors, I'm on a journey to make sense of, well, what just doesn't make sense. And today's story comes out of the world of true crime, and it's a story on everyone's mind right now. But really quick, before we dive in, if you are a new listener, I want to give you a personal shout out and say thank you so much for tuning in. I'm glad you found me. I'm glad you're here and I'm thankful for you and I hope you stick around. If you have not already dove into part one of this series, you may want to do that before listening to this episode. Otherwise, you might miss some vital information in this whole entire story. But otherwise, let's continue on with part two of the Moscow murders. So in part one, I dove into who each of the victims were. We did a deep dive into who the suspect of the four murders, Brian Koberger, was. I gave you insight into the forensic profiling of the suspect, his history, details about what happened the day of the murder, all of which led up to this very moment where we will now begin diving into what led police to the arrest of Brian Koberger. What exactly was included in the arrest affidavit? After we go into that, I will go on to discuss details included in the search warrant affidavit and what police took for possible evidence. And I'll finish it off with the defense strategy they claim they will use to defend Brian Koberger. If you stick around, also at the end, there will be some things that I cover as well, because this is such a internationally known case. You obviously have a ton of online sleuths that have saturated the internet with just bizarre, wild claims and theories. And a lot of them are misinformation and they're not true, but they're being spread as truth. So I want to cover some of those and go over some of the false information that's out there on the case. Like I had mentioned in part one, I'm not here to... I know that it's fun. A lot of people like to dive into the conspiracy world like I do. And the more bizarre, the better. It attracts people. It gets likes. It gets views. And so unfortunately, we're in the social media age. We have a lot of people out there who aren't really caring very much about the case itself. They're more focused on getting likes and views and trying to get their name out there. And that's a lot of this online sleuth community who are out there trying to allegedly solve crimes. And so I don't want to be a part of that world, especially when it comes to a case that is real. We have real victims in this case, and I don't want to put fire on any of the conspiracy theories out there. I don't want to spread rumors. I'm very much sticking to the facts of this case. So before we get into today's episode, I do want to mention the way that our criminal system or our criminal justice system works is he is presumed innocent until proven guilty. Anything I say in this episode acknowledges that, and any speculation I make is my own opinion. So as always, please do your own research. Make sure that you are verifying where you're getting your information. And take whatever people say as that hasn't been verified as a grain of salt. And also, please let me know your thoughts on this case. I also do need to put a trigger warning on this episode because we do talk about murder and some very sensitive topics that can trigger some people. This is not suitable for all audience, so listener discretion is advised. And remember, this is in story form, not informative. I find it helps people to understand it better and remember it. But okay, here we go. In the aftermath of the Idaho murders, the friends and family are just trying to make sense of this horrific tragedy. The police had to face the pressure of not just the community, but of the entire world watching this case. you had multiple news outlets that were reporting that there was growing frustration in this unsolved crime. And the lack of information that was being released to the public was extremely infuriating. The police were keeping everyone in the dark because they were obviously building their case. They needed to gather enough information to make an arrest and to be able to hold this person in jail with enough evidence gathered. They couldn't risk compromising the investigation by releasing too much information. What police were keeping from the public was that on November 29th, a Washington State University officer had discovered the white Elantra. Remember, I had talked about in part one that this white Elantra was kind of on the police's radar for a little while, and they, you know, went to the public and asked for help on who was the owner of this white Elantra. So this person who worked at Washington State University had discovered the white Elantra parked in a student apartment parking lot. The car came back as registered to Brian Koberger. And when police looked at a picture of the person registered to the car, something very specific stood out that you'll understand a little bit later in this story. But they noticed the man had bushy eyebrows. They discovered that his car had been previously registered in Pennsylvania. And 5 days after the murders, with his registration set to expire, he then registered his vehicle in Washington State. I mean, was this a tactical move on his part? Not sure. But while authorities were searching for a killer, Brian Koberger was headed home for the holidays. Koberger thinks he's going to be having a white Christmas with his family. But soon, police found out that Michael Koberger, his father, had a plane ticket to Seattle, Washington on December 11th. And they had planned that his father would fly out and meet up with Brian and that they would drive back to Pennsylvania together for the holidays. I mean, could Brian have known at this time that police were looking for a white Elantra and he just wanted it out of sight? So he planned to drive all the way back home rather than fly. I mean, I just kind of find it odd that he would want to drive all the way across the country in the middle of winter just for the holidays. Why not fly back and just, you know, use your parents' car if you need to go somewhere? So I just found that kind of weird. I think he knew that maybe the police were potentially looking for him. So Brian and his dad leave Washington to make the long drive to Pennsylvania on December 13th. But at this time, the police were already on alert and they had completely tracked Brian's every movement back to Pennsylvania. And on December 13th, Brian's license plate was captured by a license plate reader in Loma, Colorado. And 2 days later in Indiana, there is police body cam footage that shows Brian being pulled over for following too close to another vehicle.
Hello, how you doing?
How y'all doing today?
Good, good. Take a look at your driver's license real quick if I could. Is this your car? Okay, cool. Where are you headed?
We're coming from WSU.
Okay, I'm having a hard time hearing you because of the traffic. So you're coming from Washington State University?
Yeah.
And you're going where?
We're
going
to be going to Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. So y'all work at the university there?
Actually, we work there.
Oh. Okay. Well, do me a favor, don't follow too close, okay?
No.
So in this video, it's hard to hear, but the police ask where they're going, and Brian immediately says, "We're gonna go get Thai food." And that's when his dad chimes in and says, "Actually, we are driving all the way from WSU." And I think that's just like an odd thing to say to an officer when you know you're driving cross country. I have personally done it multiple times and have gotten pulled over. And the first thing I mention is, you know, like I was driving cross country, like similar to what his dad said. So could Brian be trying not to draw attention to where he is coming from, considering this is a national story at this point and he knows cops are looking for a white Elantra from the WSU area? So Brian's face in this video looks clearly surprised as well. And you can also hear the officer ask again what they're doing. And Brian says again, just going to get Thai food. Then his dad, who clearly understands what is being asked of him, says, actually, we are headed to Pennsylvania. So that makes me wonder as well, if he didn't want to give up the location of where he was headed, just in case this whole thing, the cops begin to piece together what's going on. But unbeknownst to Brian, the police had already been tracking him the entire time. Now, a little while later, Brian gets pulled over again for tailgating. The interaction is also found on police body cam, and in both instances, they are let go, which is a warning. And according to authorities, surveillance video shows Brian Koberger's vehicle in Albrights, Pennsylvania on December 16th. Once Koberger is back in Pennsylvania, police are keeping a close eye on him and tracking his movements. They see when he goes out at night, and then they see him take the garbage out one night from their house and put it in the trash can at the neighbor's house. And this makes police suspicious, thinking that maybe this really is the guy. And I mean, why would you do that? Did he think that soon the police would be onto him, so he needed to switch up some DNA just in case they went through the family trash? I mean, this guy had a degree in criminology. I think he knows a lot of the tactics that police use. But just before dawn on December 30th, Pennsylvania SWAT team raided the family home of 28-year-old Brian Koberger and arrested him for the quadruple homicide of Kaylee, Maddie, Zaina, and Ethan. One thing that I would also like to mention before we get too much further. When Brian was arrested, one of the first things he asked was, "Did you arrest anyone else?" I mean, this is kind of insinuating that someone else was involved with him. And this reminded me of John Wayne Gacy when he said the same thing. It was almost like a power grab, like he was trying to manipulate the police. But police have said on camera that they believe Brian was the only person involved in the killings. And I'm pretty sure that Brian also was following all the social media rumors that were out there. And I do remember that I briefly said it in part one, but there was this professor that worked at, I think it was it WSU? I think it was WSU. But she had to sue a TikToker who allegedly was a clairvoyant, a psychic, and she had 115,000 followers. She was saying to her followers that one of the victims was having an affair with her and that she had hired somebody to kill the victims. And so I wonder if Brian's just, you know, trying to play a mind game and get other people involved in the case. But I mean, the professor has been completely like, she's been cleared from any association. And even afterwards, the TikToker was going online and still stating that this professor is still involved. But it just makes you wonder if he's trying to like play into some of the theories out there. But 4 days later, Brian has an extradition hearing in Monroe County, Pennsylvania. He stood in front of a judge and he waived his extradition. His entire family was there at the hearing to support him, and his mother was terribly upset. Brian had turned around at one point and mouthed, "I love you," to her. Brian was then shipped back off to Idaho, and he was escorted across an airfield. He was completely shackled, and he was taken to face his charges. According to Kaylee's parents, who wanted to be at Brian's first court hearing so that they could look him directly in the eye, apparently he never even looked back. He never even gave any emotions, but Brian believed or believes that he will be exonerated from this. But that affidavit was the key to getting an inside look in what we all have been wondering this entire time. Police were seen in an interview with a reporter stating that there are things in this case that they think will shock a lot of people, indicating that there are still more bombshells that that will later be dropped in this case that wasn't included in the affidavit. Now, the morning after Brian is back in Idaho soil, authorities unseal the arrest affidavit, revealing what they think happened inside the house the night of the murders and the evidence that led to his arrest. The affidavit in this case begins at 4 p.m. This is 12 hours after the murder, with Corporal Brett Payne of the Moscow Police arriving at the scene, and he takes the reader through each level of the house. As Officer Payne approaches the first bedroom, he sees a body of which appears to be Zaina Kernodal, and next to him was her boyfriend, Ethan Chapin, both deceased. He proceeds upstairs to the third floor, and he stops at Kaylee's bedroom, where her dog Murphy had been found earlier in the day by first responders. One thing to note is that a lot of people wondered why Brian didn't kill the dog, considering the dog could alert others in the house of an intruder. And people seem to have theorized that it could be because Brian had turned vegan at one point. And maybe his desire to not harm animals because of that was the motivation behind that decision, which I find to be a pretty ballsy move on his part. So now Officer Payne moves on to the second room on the third floor. This is Maddie's room. And Officer Payne writes, "As I entered this bedroom, I could see two females in the single bed in the room. Both Gonzalez and Mogan were deceased with visible stab wounds." And I want to pause right there and just take a moment to reflect back on the 911 call that was placed and why a sea of students seemed to have been confused and just mentioned that someone was unconscious. I mean, this seemed to have been a brutal crime scene. The victims had visible stab wounds. Like, why wasn't that mentioned? The whole thing just gets even more bizarre for me. But I don't want to attack people who really weren't involved in the homicides, because a lot of them have been attacked by the online sleuth community. They have been cleared as not being involved, but we can never say why people act the way they do after a crime. But I just found it so bizarre that you have such a brutal crime scene and it's 9 hours after the murders happened that the police finally get called. There's already students there. And they seem to be confused that somebody is unconscious, but yet there's four murdered students there, that it's pretty obvious. So it's just weird. So as police begin looking in the room, they notice a tan leather knife sheath, but no knife. And it's in bed right next to Maddie. Could Maddie and Kaylee have been the first targets or the original targets of the killer? Or is this an indication of who the real target was and the rest was just what happened because those people were there? This leather sheath was... I'll back up on that, actually, because I did find it odd that all four of the victims were murdered, but two people in the house have survived. And if Brian Koberger had been looking into these victims and doing his research into them, I think he would have known that there were five roommates or five people that lived together. I mean, wouldn't he have asked, like, where are the other two people, or go into any of the other rooms? So it's just odd that he chose just these four victims and left two survivors. Now, this leather sheath was very significant for police to find. The sheath was called a K-bar and has a Marine insignia on it, which implies that it's a combat knife. This is a serious knife. And this leaves police to wonder, is this the cover to the murder weapon? Now, there is no filler in this affidavit. This affidavit had a treasure trove of information in it. The entire document zeroes in on a very critical period of time between 4 a.m. and 4:25 a.m. And according to the affidavit, the two surviving roommates confirm that the housemates and Zaina's boyfriend, Ethan, were all home by 2 a.m. And at 4 a.m., Zaina gets a DoorDash delivery. Based on what police retrieved from Zaina's phone, they believe she was still awake and on TikTok at 4:12 a.m. And at approximately the same time that Zaina's DoorDash was received, one of the surviving roommates woke up. That roommate was what the affidavit describes with the initials DM. This is what she tells police, that she woke up because she thought that she had heard Kaylee playing with her dog Murphy on the third floor. She then heard who she thought was Gonzalez saying something to the effect of, "There's someone here." DM told police that she opened the door, peeked outside, but didn't see anything. She opened the door a second time because she believed she heard crying from Zaina's room. Something really chilling was that DM told police that she heard a male voice saying, "It's okay. I'm going to help you." Now, what does that mean? It doesn't say when she heard that and if it was before or after 4:12 a.m. But the next timestamp in the affidavit is at 4:17 a.m. when a nearby security camera picks up what sounds like voices, some whimpering, and then a thud. Also, a dog could be heard barking repeatedly starting at 4:17 a.m. What made the dog bark just then? So at this time, says that DM then looked out a third time, and that is when she saw a man dressed in black wearing a mask covering his nose and mouth. She described him to be 5'10 or taller, an athletic but not muscular build, and bushy eyebrows. This man walked past her towards the back sliding glass door, and she stood in a, quote, frozen, shocked phase. She told authorities that at that point, she locked her bedroom door. And now, the way this house was designed is that in the front of the house, you can see three stories, but in the back of the house, there was a hill that came up to the second floor. So the killer left from the back of the house out the second floor, which led to a back hill area that went up to a student parking area where the killer could have been parked, which lines up with more details I'll get into about where this white Elantra was spotted leaving the area. It's also very odd to me that the roommate was so scared at that point, yet she didn't think to call the police or scream to check on her friends or text the roommate down below or maybe wake up earlier to see what was going on. I don't know why she didn't try to like reach out to some of the other people in the house if she was that scared. I don't know. It's weird to me. I can't really say how intoxicated people act. I don't know if she was intoxicated, but apparently it was like a huge party time for the entire area, the whole town. And so you had probably a lot of people who were underage and they were drunk, and I don't know. I can't really speculate, but it just seemed like bizarre behavior. And maybe because she had been drinking and she might have been like hungover, she slept in pretty late. And so that's why the phone call came in a little bit later. But that's the only thing I can think of. And why did Brian spare the other roommates? I mean, did he see DM as he was walking by her? Because she states that he walked right by her, but it was dark. And I think that there's a potential that he actually didn't even see her when he walked by her. So we don't really know if Brian Koberger actually spared her life even after seeing her, or if he really didn't even see that she was there and he just wanted to get out of there. So the cops now have a little bit of information about the suspect and they begin their manhunt. At this point, police engage in what's known as a video canvas. hoping to find something on surveillance camera that might give them a clue as to who this person might be. And authorities identify a white sedan in the area starting at 3:29 a.m. This wasn't a random vehicle that just drove by in the middle of the night. There were three passes of this vehicle, and ultimately, there was the fourth. They see the same car come back at 4:04 a.m., and it looks like it's either trying to park or turn around, but that car is seen again around 4:20 a.m. It's darting down Kings Road area at a high rate of speed. An FBI forensics examiner identified that white sedan as a white 2011 through 2016 Hyundai Elantra. So that's why Moscow police issued a request to other police departments to be on the lookout for a white Elantra. This is basically when the police make this discovery and they ask people for information on this white Elantra. So now we're 4 days later, and two police officers at Washington State University make the same discovery, and they find a 2015 white Hyundai Elantra, which is registered to Brian Koberger. And as police are digging into Brian Koberger, they found that he had two recent traffic stops. And one of those encounters found that he had provided a phone number to the police officer. Now they have a cell phone that they can do a search warrant on, and now they can start looking into the location of that cell phone during the time of the murders. His comings and goings before, during, and after the killings were all tracked. And according to the affidavit, this cell phone data shows at 2:47 a.m., Brian's phone is no longer at his home, and then suddenly stops reporting any information to the tower, which means it's either in airplane mode or it's off the grid or it's been turned off. Almost exactly 2 hours later at 4:48 a.m., the phone again registers back on the grid and appears to be moving away from Moscow, Idaho to Pullman. So you have the cell phone that goes dark at 2:48 or 2:47 a.m. and it then reappears at 4:48 a.m. and it's coming from Pullman area, or it's coming from Moscow area to Pullman. And according to the affidavit, less than 4 hours later, Brian's cell phone is on the move again between 9:12 a.m. and 9:20 a.m. And it appears to return to the area of the King Road residence before the police were even there. And a lot of people wondered, like, why would Brian go back to that area before that time? Or, I mean, after this whole murder case happened. But I kind of think that Brian potentially was going back to the scene to see if, you know, all hell had broken loose at that point. You know, if he is the killer, maybe he just couldn't wait to see the response of what he had created and wanted to go back and see if the bodies had been found yet. But it's weird to me that he would go back to that area, but it wouldn't surprise me if he had that sick, sadistic mindset of a serial killer to want to go back and relish in his own creation. But the way that the authorities were able to connect the car to the cell phone records and to the crime scene back to Brian Koberger, I mean, this is all a very powerful affidavit. The affidavit essentially lays out what is called critical mass, where eventually all of the clues start stacking up and painting this bigger picture. So the video surveillance cameras, the cell phone pings, the physical description, all of it starts to come together. But authorities are about to reveal a detail hiding in plain sight that seems to connect Brian Koberger directly to this murder scene. Now, in crime scene investigations, one of the most important things that police are looking for is DNA. So, was there any DNA left behind from the perpetrator. And usually, when there has been an incredibly violent and intimate murder like this was, it's almost impossible for the killer to not leave behind his own DNA. And what they are looking for can vary. I mean, it could be blood, semen, saliva, or even a single hair. It could be touch DNA, which is just a few skin cells, and it can be just a tiny amount of DNA. And one of the challenges in this case was that a lot of people lived in this house and a lot of people were in and out, friends visiting. I mean, like there was a sea of students. So it's kind of like a soup of DNA. Not to mention, like I just said, when the police first arrived at the crime scene, it was said that they were greeted with a sea of students, all of which could have contaminated the investigation from the beginning. But remember that tan leather knife sheath that had been left behind in the bedroom. That would be a huge clue for investigators if they were able to find DNA evidence on that. So obviously, there is glove wearing at the crime scene. You have the CSI people and they're picking this thing up. They're preserving it so as not to damage or destroy any potential DNA on this knife sheath, because this is like, if they can find the killer's DNA on this knife sheath, then that's kind of like the smoking gun, right? So they enclose it and it gets sent to a crime lab where they do everything in their power to connect it to a killer. So what they do at the crime lab is they swab all the different parts of it, including the button on the strap that held the knife in place. And this is kind of like the smoking gun here. But on that button, they found a single source of male DNA. And that's really important because that ties it back to just one male. I mean, when you have like all this DNA in a crime scene, you have the potential knife sheet that held the murder weapon that has a single form of male DNA on it. So if they run it through what's called CODIS, which is a big database of criminal DNA, and there is no match, that tells them that the killer is likely not a previous offender. And we know Brian's not really a previous offender. He is very much in law enforcement and did a bunch of stuff in like criminal justice and all that kind of stuff. So he's probably tried to stay out of being a criminal. He's probably tried not to get in trouble with the law. But investigators then have the option to upload the suspect's profile to a public database and see if they can get a hit on a relative. This is sources like Ancestry and 23andMe. So they may have been performing parallel investigations where they start the investigative genetic genealogy like very early. And what they do during that time is they would have gotten their match list and then begin building a family tree. And they're basically looking for common ancestors in those trees so they can piece back together the true identity of this unknown perpetrator. But investigators in Idaho already had a head start on who their suspect was because of that white 2015 Hyundai Elantra. And that was Brian Koberger. According to the affidavit, the cops have their name of the suspect, they have a car, and they've tracked the suspect back to their home in Pennsylvania, and they're completely under surveillance. So the next step is to find a way to match the DNA that they have in their possession to Brian Koberger. Police now know that Brian is back home in Pennsylvania with his family for Christmas break. So the FBI and other authorities get a search warrant to grab the family trash bag. Legally, when you throw something away in the trash, you have abandoned your trash, or I guess you can say your DNA, when you basically throw it away. And most states allow for your trash to be picked up by law enforcement and searched. So they're looking for items in the trash bag that can be swabbed for DNA. And those items like cups, tissues, anything that your mouth would have touched, like a soda can, pop bottle, Those items are then sent back to the state lab in Idaho for analysis. And this trash was processed, and the smoking gun here, there was a match. So the DNA on the sheath matched DNA found in the family trash. And that's how they were able to confirm that the DNA from the trash was very likely from the father of the individual who left the DNA behind at the crime scene. The match to the dad is a home run for investigators because he shares 50% of the suspect's DNA, which means this is a 99.9998% chance that the DNA found on that knife sheath belongs to Brian Koberger. So, I mean, basically, you add all this great circumstantial evidence, which is very powerful, to this incredible DNA statistic, and this just sounds like a smoking gun, right? I mean, this gives police, as seen in the probable cause affidavit, everything they need to get in and get this guy in cuffs. So once they got Brian in custody, they did the old cheek swab, taking it directly from the primary suspect. And that definitely told police that, I mean, they've got their guy because they tested that. And at that point, all the rest of the DNA analysis and investigation becomes irrelevant because what's important is getting that exact match. So being able to say that the chances of this individual leaving behind their DNA at the crime scene are one in, let's say, 300 trillion. That's more than we have people on this planet. That's an astronomical probability. So how could Brian Koberger's attorneys mount a defense against those odds, right? So now that Brian Koberger has been arrested, students begin bracing themselves to return back to campus. And it's now January 12th, and it's Brian Koberger's first hearing in Moscow, Idaho. It's basically a hearing that concludes when his preliminary hearing will be. All suspects in Idaho are given a right to a speedy preliminary hearing within 14 days. A preliminary hearing is basically where the police and prosecution present all the evidence they have, and the judge will then decide if they have enough to hold the suspect in custody or if they even have enough evidence to bring the suspect to trial for murder. And due to the immense amount of evidence that was shown in the affidavit, Brian's defense attorney asked for more time, and Brian Koberger actually waived his right to a speedy trial. The defense needed at least 6 months to build a defense strategy for Brian. So they set Brian's preliminary hearing to June 26th of 2023. And there are images of him in the hearing that shows Brian with a lot of cuts on his face, apparently from shaving. And ABC also reported that there is extra security watching Koberger at all times. Now, in the meantime, the judge has proposed a gag order prohibiting lawyers or investigators from publicizing any details about the case. So it's basically balancing the rights of Brian Koberger and the public's right to know. And I mean, it's a delicate balance, but one that has to be maintained in pursuing a fair trial for Brian, because, you know, just like a lot of the online sleuths that convicted all these people who weren't even attached to the case, there's still this lingering feeling that people have about anything that you say. When you put something out into the ether, the community, the consciousness, whatever, and you state your case on it and somebody believes your case, they start to believe that this person is a suspect. And no matter if somebody comes in like Brian Koberger and happens to actually be the real suspect, some people are still going to have these feelings or these convictions against people that are close to the case that they thought before had been tied to it. So it just makes it hard to have a fair trial when you have something that's so publicized. But before I get into what the defense strategy is, I want to briefly talk about what was included in the search warrant affidavit. This was released and unsealed after this arrest warrant affidavit came out. But I'm not going to completely go over everything that was in it because a lot of it is irrelevant. I think the most relevant part of this was the items that police took that they believed had potential evidence that is tied to this case. So I'm going to read off some of those items so that you have an understanding of things that might be included in this trial. So when you read the arrest warrant affidavit, I mean, there's a ton of pages that are a part of it, but police can't just go into a house and start taking whatever it is that they want. They have to lay out a basis for the judge on what exactly are they looking for? What is the reason that they think that they deserve to go in and search the area for evidence? So they have to give very specific things of what they're looking for, and then they have to document the items that could potentially fall under what it is that they're looking for. So in the affidavit, they had written that some of the items that they're looking for include blood or other bodily fluid or human tissue or skin cells, knives, sheaths, or other sharp tools, including any daggers, swords, or any of that kind of stuff, any images, whether digital or on paper or any other format, which shows Ethan Chapin, Kaylee Gonzalez, Zaina Kernodle, Madison Mogan, and any of the other two surviving victims. Clothing, including but not limited to dark shirt, dark pants, mask, shoes with diamond pattern soles. Trace evidence, including DNA from blood or skin cells or other sources like footprints, fingerprints, hair, whether it's human or dog. And then data compilations, which are digital, electronic, or paper forms showing an interest in or planning of murder and violent assault, stabbing, and or cutting of people and all that stuff. So based on that, here's the items that they seized from Brian Koberger's residence. So they seized one nitrite type black glove, one Walmart receipt with one Dickies tag, two Marshall's receipts, a dust container from Bissell Power Force Vacuum, eight possible hair strands, one Fire TV stick with a cord slash plug, one possible animal hair strand, one possible hair, one possible hair, one possible hair, one possible hair, so multiple hair strands, one computer tower, one collection of a dark red spot, potentially blood, but it was collected without testing. Two cuttings from uncased pillow of reddish brown stains. The larger stain was tested. Two top and bottom of mattress cover packaged separately, both labeled C and has multiple stains. One of them is tested. So out of all the places that they had searched pertaining to Brian Koberger, those are the items that they seized. And I guess we will find out more of this story once the trial happens in June 26th of 2023. But despite what authorities say is a convincing amount of evidence of guilt, a resolution in this case is likely years away. The defense is going to pump the brakes in a huge way. And what they're going to want to do is they're going to want to create as much distance as possible between the horror of this case and the ultimate presentation of evidence in front of the jury. Because there is a mountain of information and evidence that has been presented, there is still a lot of things that were collected at the crime scene that needs to still be analyzed. You have more DNA evidence that needs to be sifted through from the lab. You have all the evidence that the prosecution has and needs that still hand over to the defense. It needs to be tested by them, by the defense. So this is going to be a long road to justice. And I think that what will happen next will be that Brian enters a not guilty plea and then a discovery process will happen. And I think a trial is extremely likely in this case, especially when Brian Koberger believes that he's going to be exonerated of all of the charges. One thing that the defense team has come out and said is that they will be attacking the DNA that was found on the sheath. And remember, the defense is really just going based off of what the arrest warrant affidavit is. And if you look at the arrest warrant affidavit, the way that they painted the picture, I mean, it really does make it look like Brian Koberger was the murderer in this case. And unfortunately, when you look at some of the things that were inside of the arrest warrant affidavit, you can actually start to pick those things apart. It's not as cut and dry when you have DNA evidence at the crime scene. And the issue with the DNA that was found is that it is what is known as touch DNA, and it comes from someone's bare skin. And it can last for a very long time on an item that a person touches. And because of that, what they will likely argue is that it could have been transferred. The DNA could have been on the sheath for a very long time, and perhaps Brian gave that knife sheath away and someone else could have transported that to the crime scene. I mean, they have already commented about how cell phone data is not an exact science and can be extremely inaccurate. There was also people who lived near Brian that said he was a night owl and that you could hear him up vacuuming at all hours of the night. So clearly it wasn't out of the norm for Brian to be up and awake at the hour of which this crime occurred. One of Brian's friends was on camera stating that they often went on 7 mile or longer runs at night. And remember that the victims lived only 10 miles from the house. So could this be the reason his cell phone pinged in that area over 12 times prior to the murders? Police stated that Brian Koberger was stalking the victims prior to, because his cell phone had been in the area and pinged in that area 12 times prior to the murder. But could Brian have just been out running and had his cell phone on them? And when you look at how cell phone towers ping, there's a certain radius, and sometimes they can ping 20 miles away from where the person actually is, depending on if there's buildings in the area or how many towers are in the area, those kinds of things. So they're definitely going to hone in on this cell phone pinging, and they're probably going to try and rip it apart, especially when you have Brian who didn't live far from the area. But I mean, maybe he was just out on a late night run, but that could be a strategy that the defense will choose to use. But I mean, can you kind of see now how they will be able to poke holes in the prosecution's case? I mean, we still have a lot that is yet to be revealed. So there could be a lot more evidence that ties him to the case. They might find a lot more DNA from him there, which probably isn't touch DNA, but if they had blood DNA, that's kind of like the big smoking gun. They can't really say that that was transferred. So now I just want to touch base on some of the theories that have been proven to be false online. There is some speculation that has come out. Obviously, I talked about the professor. I talked about Kaylee's ex-boyfriend, who she had recently broken up with. A lot of people speculated that he was a suspect. And those people have been completely cleared from the case. So we're not really going to focus on those. But there is a lot of information that a lot of media people have been kind of commenting on. And one of them was that Brian Koberger had visited the Mad Cow restaurant where two of the victims worked and had been there right before the murders happened. That was actually confirmed by the restaurant itself and people who worked there that Brian Koberger did not actually visit the restaurant prior to the murders. Now, remember in part one where I discussed that prior to the murders, they had some noise complaints and police had shown up to the house and addressed the loud music. A lot of speculation online was that because Brian Koberger was stalking the victims beforehand, that it's potential that he was behind the calls to the police for the noise complaints. But the reality of that was that that was not true because two of the three complaints on the evening of September 1st and the early morning of September 2nd, they were identified in police reports as neighbors of the King Road home in Moscow. But both calls came from houses on Walenta Drive, which is the street behind the six-bedroom off-campus rental house. So that was just a false theory that is lingering around there. So there was another thing that hasn't specifically been verified by the police, but this is information that was leaked by People magazine. And they allegedly claimed that they got their information because they were citing an investigator that was familiar with the case. And then allegedly, they did their own review of this now deleted account on Instagram, which is Brian Koberger's account. It's now deleted, but they were able to have access to who Brian Koberger followed before the account was actually deleted. And allegedly, Brian Koberger had followed all three of the girls, Zaina, Maddie, and Kaylee, on Instagram, and then allegedly, repeatedly messaged one of the girls, which we don't know who that was. I personally kind of think it was Maddie, but that's just my own speculation. But apparently, he didn't get a response. So I'm going to kind of dive into that really quick. Now, again, just kind of like hold this with a grain of salt, because even the source that I was looking into for this had stated that Brian Koberger had visited the restaurant where two of the victims worked beforehand. But like I said, that has been verified to be false. So it very well could that this information will come out to be false. But People magazine did report that they did see that he had followed the girls beforehand, but allegedly he contacted one of the female victims repeatedly in late October, which was roughly 2 weeks before the killings. He didn't really say anything like negative or angry. He was just like, hey, how are you? Hey, how are you? Trying to get attention, but he never received a response, allegedly. And that's pretty easy to do on Instagram. I don't know if you're really familiar with all of the messaging and like the formats for that. Sometimes there's like a primary and then there's general and then there's like a request area. And a lot of times if you're following somebody and they're not following back, so Brian Koberger was following them, but they weren't following him back. So if you go to message somebody who you guys don't follow each other, that message will go into a request folder. So if you go to your messages, you'll see up at the top, if you have a request, there will have like how many requests you have. And you can click on that and there will be even more requests. But even sometimes those are looked at by Instagram as spam, and it will go to an even further folder called hidden requests. And that will be like where they put some messages that they think are spam or promoting or any of that kind of stuff. So this very well could have been like him trying to make contact, but she just never checked her request messages and never saw it. Or she just didn't want to respond to him. But there was nothing that he was like, hey, it didn't seem angry, any of the messages that he was trying to get her to reach out to him, and she wasn't responding. So he was answering with angry messages. There was none of that. Another recent news that came out that I find to be worth noting that I thought was odd was that the mother of Zaina Kernodle had been working with the defense attorney of Brian Koberger. So she actually wanted the defense attorney that Brian Koberger has now to represent her daughter, who's the victim, Zaina Kernodle. And I guess she was representing the victim. And then according to this defense attorney, she thought that it could potentially be a compromise with the case because she knows the person who's involved with the victim. And so she decided to drop the representing Zaina Kernodle and decide to represent the killer, Brian Koberger. I mean, That's just like wild. But also, I feel like that was kind of a power move potentially, because how many like attorneys out there get famous off of famous cases? If you're the person who represents the defendant, there's going to be all eyes on you. And I feel like there could have been that opportunity for her. This could be one of her big cases and she can get noticed. You know what I mean? So like, I don't really know what the reasoning behind that truly was, but she stated it could just be conflict of interest because she knew Zaina Kernodle's mom and she was working on a case with her, I guess, for drug charges. And so she decided to drop the being the victim's defense attorney and decided to go with Brian Koberger, the killer of the victim. Now, I could go on and on about a lot of the other stuff that's out there, but I think those were kind of the ones worth noting because they are kind of in the big media outlets. Some of the other stuff I'm not even going to go into because I think it's just, it goes to say that if you hear something and it's speculation, take it with a grain of salt. But if there is something that has been verified by police, then, you know, take that as something that's involved in the case. So just be careful about a lot of the stuff that you guys are researching online about this. But I think the burning question we have right now is why? Why did he do it? What were his connections with the victims? One thing that was also included in the affidavit that I did not say was that there was also a Vans shoe print that was found at the crime scene, but it may not prove to be that of Brian Koberger. That's another thing that the defense strategy was tearing apart, because there was one of the police body cams from when the house was visited for a noise complaint showed one of the victims wearing Vans shoes. So, I mean, it can't be tied yet to this case, but they were looking for shoes in Brian Koberger's house. As you could tell from the search warrant, they didn't find anything that had a diamond shoe print on it, which is the van shoe. But the police also have not yet found the murder weapon. Can it be found before this goes to trial? And one thing to note, though, since I'm sure everyone wants to know what the motive is, it's actually not an element of the crime. And oftentimes, people, they don't know what the motive behind, you know, a human being taking the life of another human being. And as prosecutors, they don't actually have to prove that in court. They don't have to prove a motive for murder. I mean, it makes for a stronger case. But as the prosecution begins to put this whole case together, the defense will most likely try to attack each piece separately. So, you know, time will only tell what the real details of this case will reveal. And I am looking forward to the day when these families can finally find justice. That concludes the two-part series of the University of Idaho murders. And as this all comes out, maybe in the future when we have all the evidence and all the information that was put in trial, I will do another episode on this. But as for now, I am going to leave that case to where it is. And I just want to say thank you so much for tuning in. I will see you again in a couple weeks for a new episode of the Chiller Queen podcast. And if you have any information on this case that I missed, or maybe I didn't really miss it, I just didn't include it in the episodes, but if you have anything that you want me to see that maybe I missed and maybe I can do another episode because there's just this bombshell stuff that I don't actually know about, please reach out to me on chillerqueenpodcast@gmail.com. You can also go to my website and reach out to me there. You can also connect with me on Instagram, chillerqueenpodcast. Everything is included down in the show notes, guys. But bye for now, friends. Stay weird and don't forget to question everything.